This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, the Great Lakes are the greatest freshwater reservoirs in the world, but the wetlands around them are disappearing, and this is hurting the lakes themselves. Continuing our series on the origins of life, we examine the moon for clues. Some scientists think the moon is older than the Earth. We look at the next generation of recycling. It's the toothbrush made of recycled plastic that you send back to the manufacturer when it's worn out. And on the Earth calendar, farmers in New England are boiling the last saprons as the maple syrup season comes to an end. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Over the years, we've heard a lot about protecting the Great Lakes. Invasive aquatic life like the lamprey eel and zebra mussel, which found their way into the lakes from elsewhere, have had a significant impact on plants and fish that are native to the area. In an earlier time, pollution almost killed Lake Erie. But now, one of the greatest threats to the Great Lakes is not occurring in the water, but on the shorelines. It's the destruction of the wetlands that nurture the fish, cleanse the water, and provide habitat for the birds. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
You probably already know that the five Great Lakes border the United States and Canada, but can you name all five? Maybe your school teacher gave you the acronym HOMES to help. It is Huron, Ontario, Michigan, Erie, and Superior. The Great Lakes make up the largest freshwater supply in the world, and at one time, they were filled with productive wetland areas. But over the years, these diverse ecosystems have been diminishing, both in size and quality. David Jude is a research scientist with the Center for Great Lakes and Aquatic Sciences at the University of Michigan.
First of all, we've had a tremendous decline in wetlands, and of course, everybody has heard about the fact that, for example, I think in Lake Erie it's cited that 10% of the original wetlands are now remaining. And of those 10%, virtually all of those are degraded in some way or another. And there's one Old Woman Creek estuary, for example, which is a national estuary and is protected. That's the only one that's really left that has a natural connection with Lake Erie. And that has sort of been a trend throughout the Great Lakes.
Wetland areas are the most productive ecosystems in the entire Great Lakes. Thousands of plants and animals reside in these areas year-round, and migrating species use them as rest stops during their annual trips. Water levels fluctuate from year to year in wetlands, which helps new plant species emerge. The Great Lakes marshes are therefore constantly changing, which helps promote biodiversity and the fragile web of life. But a number of factors are contributing to the loss of wetland areas.
In western Lake Erie in particular, where historically there were vast areas of wetland, an area called the Great Black Swamp, most of that has been turned into agricultural land through drainage efforts that have taken place over the last century or so.
That's Dr. Doug Wilcox, a researcher with the U.S. Geological Survey's Great Lakes Science Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He has studied the Great Lakes almost all of his life. Dr. Wilcox says housing developments placed in former wetland areas are also contributing to their loss in the Great Lakes. He says concrete walls, constructed to help protect developed areas, are a problem because they stop floodwaters and tides from entering areas that promote plant and animal diversity. Wilcox says pollution is also taking its toll on wetlands.
There are also problems in wetlands related to some discharges, so to be, nutrient discharges, both point source and non-point source discharges coming off from agricultural lands, for instance, or lawns that have fertilizer added to them. To some extent, there are still permitted industrial discharges to various extents. Many of the sewage treatment plants have discharges following treatment, discharges that end up going into river systems that have wetlands at the downstream end of it right along the lake.
Another problem facing wetland areas in at least one of the Great Lakes is the lack of rising or falling levels. Dr. Wilcox says since the construction of the St. Lawrence Seaway, the waterway that connects Lake Ontario to the Atlantic Ocean, water levels in Lake Ontario have been regulated.
Lake Ontario, since they began regulating lake levels, has not had any really low lake level periods. For the most part, they've been able to regulate out the high lake levels and end up with a very regular lake level curve. The problem that it's created on the upper end of in the higher elevations that never get flooded out, cattails and some of the other plants, shrubs, and including a number of upland plants, have been able to invade those areas. And on the low end, where the sediments have never been exposed, there are dense stands of a handful of submersed aquatic plants that can create problems for boaters and other things.
Dr. Wilcox says the lack of fluctuating water levels in Lake Ontario's wetlands has caused a decline in biological diversity. Meanwhile, there are laws that are supposed to protect wetland areas from development and other forces. But too often, debates occur over what constitutes such an area. Again, David Jude with the Center for Great Lakes and Aquatic Sciences.
There is one particular classification system out there now called a gentleman named Cowardin published it, but it's a generalized one, and I think we need to really improve our understanding of Great Lakes wetlands and help with this regulatory issue and help with rehabilitating some of these areas. We need to better be able to classify them so that we know what we're talking about, the developers and the DNRs and any other officials that are involved with this.
In addition to the biodiversity issue surrounding wetland loss is the economic effects. Many fish rely on wetland areas to spawn or prey on fish that live near these regions. Without these ecosystems, sport fishing industries can suffer, which means a loss in tourism dollars and jobs. The important questions now are how to maintain the wetland areas that remain in the Great Lakes and create more areas so the balance of nature exists for future generations. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
In our continuing series on the origins of life, we talked to two scientists about how the moon was formed. The early history of our planet and its moon is researched for clues about the conditions which led to the appearance of life. John Jones, a planetary scientist at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, says no one knows how the moon was formed, but there are various theories.
One of the current popular hypotheses among scientists these days is that a large planet about the size of Mars hit the Earth, and the resulting collision threw out debris and gas and dust and molten rock, and that coagulated to later form the moon.
Jones says there are other concepts as well.
Other possibilities are a capture, that a moon came by and fell into the Earth's gravitational attraction and stayed. This is very, very difficult, and that's probably not what happened. Another possibility is that the Earth, as it was growing, the moon grew too, alongside it, and that's perhaps more plausible.
While Jones readily admits he does not know how the moon was formed, he is skeptical about the idea that the moon was broken off the Earth as a result of a strike by another object. He says such a collision would create a huge amount of energy that would have melted and vaporized some of the Earth.
The main reason that I don't believe it personally is because I see no evidence in the terrestrial rocks themselves, the rocks that come from deep within our planet, that they have really experienced this kind of melting event.
Jones says that learning how the moon was formed can help determine the origins of life on Earth.
You can see that these two different scenarios are very different starting points for understanding life. In one case, if there was a giant impact and you've basically sterilized the whole planet, melted it and vaporized it by this impact. Life has had to overcome that. On the other hand, if it did not happen that way and the Earth accreted and grew more quiescently, then perhaps it was easier for life to get started.
Jones says there are materials on the Earth that are not found on the Moon, presumably because volcanic and igneous events on the Moon have destroyed them. He also says there is evidence of the decay of certain substances found in lunar rocks, which differs from that which is found on Earth.
The upshot of all this is that because we see these anomalies in the Moon and don't see them in the Earth, it makes it appear as though the Moon is actually older than the Earth. And especially for a giant impact model, where you would say, well, gee, probably the Earth and Moon really formed at the same time, this is difficult.
One explanation is that the Earth and the Moon grew simultaneously.
It would be possible in sort of the co-accretion model that I mentioned earlier, where the Moon sort of grew next to the Earth as the Earth was growing. It would be itself. It would be possible in that scenario to have the Moon do its thing nearby but somewhat independently.
Scientists are still debating whether a collision on Earth created the Moon. But there is little doubt that once formed, the Moon has been bombarded by space debris which produced its pockmarked surface. Dr. Graham Ryder is staff scientist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston, Texas.
Well, if the inference we make from the Apollo samples is correct, that most of these impact melts that we find are 3.85 billion years old, or 3.9, a very short period of time, then virtually everything you see when you look at the face of the Moon in the highlands was formed at that time. And prior to that, maybe it looked somewhat different than that. Maybe it looked much less pockmarked than we see it now. But everything you see, apart from the dark plains on the Moon, which were later filled with lavas, everything you see was formed in that very, very short period. And the Earth must have had the same sort of impacting if these are a inner solar system population, and therefore would have been very highly crunched too. On the Earth, however, there were tides, there was an ocean, and these would have had some effect on eroding those craters away moderately fast.
While experts believe there was a time 65 million years ago when a meteorite struck the Earth and changed things so dramatically that the dinosaurs went extinct, Dr. Ryder says the impact of the bombardments 3.9 to 3.8 billion years ago, which are still evident on the Moon and which struck the Earth as well, may not have slowed the origin of life on Earth.
Well, there are some positive aspects. It could be that life to even originate and then to develop might have needed a warmer water than we have right now. The water that we have in the oceans at the present time is not that hot, and maybe life needed it to be warmer, and maybe this impacting actually had a positive aspect to it, that it in fact provided the conditions for the origin of life rather than continually annihilated it. It may have done both, but it may have been absolutely necessary for all we know. And it may just be another example where random impacts of one sort or another have been so important in building the planets and everything that's happened to them ever since.
Coverage of the origins of life is made possible by NASA through support for the New York Center for Studies of the Origins of Life. It's located at the New York State University at Albany, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and the College of St. Rose. The Environment Show is a national production which is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. Write us a letter, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's The Environment Show at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, brushing up on recycling. A toothbrush probably won't save the planet, but a toothbrush made out of recycled plastics may be a step in the right direction. At least Eric Hudson thinks so. He's president and founder of a company called Recycline. Started in 1994 in Somerville, Massachusetts, he says the company's mission is to deliver consumers products made from recycled materials.
You know, there's a lot of recycling going on in the United States, and levels were increasing up to the 30 to 40% of consumers in several states. But there weren't a lot of products made from those materials that people were recycling. And I think as people are making that effort, they're out there also saying, well, you know, I really should be able to find something out there that is made from, you know, my efforts, is made from the materials that we recycle.
The toothbrush, called the Preserve, has a handle made from recycled polypropylene plastic. Commercially, this plastic is found in such items as bottle caps and yogurt containers. In the recycling world, that's a number 5 on the bottom of a container. Hudson says it was chosen because of its strength and flexibility. Unfortunately, he says polypropylene is not as readily available as other plastics, like PET, a number 1 on the bottom of a container, or HDPE, a number 2, commonly used in making gallon milk jugs. So Hudson says they always need to keep an eye out for a source of materials, which vary with each production run.
And we go out to the sourcing companies and go through the materials that they've got, but most commonly, at least for our last run, we used about 60% what they are is called wafer chip containers. They're from computer companies, and it is a uncolored plastic container that a production line needs to take a chip out of and then toss that container aside. It needs to be totally sterile, and it's a nice chunk of plastic that's holding these chips, but it needs to be contained in this very, you know, durable, sterile container for that production line. And that's, you know, the companies like, let's say, Dex of the world are recycling those rather than tossing in the landfill, and we're able to use them.
Another source Recycline has used, Hudson says, is ketchup bottles. The toothbrush bristles, however, though fully recyclable, are not made from recycled material. Instead, they are made from virgin nylon. Although there are natural bristles in the market made from boar's hair or other natural fibers, Hudson says in his research, nylon was found to be softer and less likely to harbor bacteria. Hudson says that toothbrushes and their packaging account for more than 100 million pounds of waste annually in the United States. So, Recycline invites you to send your preserved toothbrush back.
Like companies in, let's say, Germany and Europe that want to, you know, think of a product from birth to death. We develop this product and the packaging, and we want to say, okay, we can do something with it when it's done. You don't have to throw it in the landfill. So what we've done is included a postage-paid mailer with each sale, and consumers are able to, when they're finished with their brush, if they're not you know, sort of scrubbing their bathroom floor for it for a while, which most people like to continue using their toothbrushes, we ask them to send it back to us with their packaging, which is a reusable canister. It comes back to Recycline, and we grind it up, and we turn it into a feed material for recycled plastic lumber products.
The toothbrushes, offered in blue, red, and green, are also specially designed with a backward-sloping handle, designed to make it easy to brush in the motion most recommended by dentists. Presently, the Preserve toothbrush is offered in supermarkets and natural food stores around the country. Although not common, making new goods out of recycled materials is nothing new. For example, Patagonia has been making a fleece from recycled soda bottles. However, the more companies doing it, the better. Eric Hudson hopes his business encourages consumers to participate in the recycling loop and maybe even encourage them to brush between meals. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Right now, the season for collecting sap from maple trees is coming to a close in New Hampshire. It's part of the Great American Harvest. Colin Christie is owner of Christie's Maple Farm in Lancaster, located at the foot of Mount Washington in the White Mountains. He collects sap from some 11,000 maple trees on his property.
Sap is obtained by drilling a small hole in the cambium layer of the tree in the spring of the year, when the tree is taking its energy that is stored in the roots, converted it to sugar, and feeding bud formation on the tree. We've got a narrow window of opportunity from when the tree wakes up out of its dormancy and creates this flow of sap, which is feeding and giving energy to bud formation on the tree. Once the buds burst on the tree, our season is over.
Christie says warmer days and freezing nights of early spring help the sap flow up from the tree's roots. To produce enough sap for commercial purposes, he says a maple tree needs to be at least 40 years old. When most people think of collecting sap, they picture sap dripping from spouts or taps that have been drilled into the trees. Buckets that hang on the taps collect the sap as it drips. While many farmers still obtain sap this way, Colin says things have changed in recent years.
In the modern world, we are presently using a plastic tubing system. This is an interconnected system of a small diameter 5/16 tubing that goes from tree to tree and then dumps into bigger main lines and heads to the bottom of the hill. That's probably one of the greatest innovations in the maple industry in past years has been the advent of tubing.
Colin Christie says what used to take a dozen men all day to collect sap from his maple trees now is the work of one man. Another innovation in sap collection is a vacuum system which lowers atmospheric pressure at the tap, allowing the sap to flow for long periods of time. The sap is brought to the sugar house where it is boiled. Boiling the sap evaporates most of the water, leaving the sweet maple syrup. Again, Colin Christie.
Presently at Christie's Maple Farm, we're using a steam-powered evaporator. We have a regular evaporator pan, and the difference in a steam pan over a conventional one is instead of a fire being under the pan, whether it be wood, gas, or oil, we are using a high-pressure steam boiler, producing steam and running it through coils in the bottom of our pans. This allows for evaporation to happen at a very efficient rate and also keeps the sap from getting too warm. There's no chances of scorching it.
Christie says it takes about 40 gallons of sap to produce 1 gallon of syrup because the sap itself is only 2% sugar. Maple syrup is a year-round business at Christie's. Colin markets his products through the farm market, mail order, and on the Internet. Besides bottled maple syrup, he produces other maple products like candies, coated peanuts, granulated sugar, and maple cream, which he says is great on bagels. But Christie says he has his own favorite way of enjoying maple syrup.
I like to take a little shot before I go to bed.
As Americans, we're plagued by obesity, much of which is caused by eating too much sugar. Suppose maple syrup, which we make ourselves, becomes our only source of sweetening. By the time you boil 40 gallons of sap for a single gallon of syrup, you would consume it more sparingly. And since many of us have neither the maple trees nor the patience for the long, slow boil, it would take sugar out of our diets entirely. It sounds like a sweet way to lose weight. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead. In the first half hour, we brushed our teeth with toothbrushes made of recycled plastic. Now, IBM tells us they make computers out of the stuff. We talk green about saving one of America's most important natural resources, farmland. Once it's mauled, it's gone forever. A green tip on dandelions, your lawn, and spring wine. And the dense fog on a river in Vermont makes the oarsman focus on what is directly before him. Concentration on the immediate sets him up to consider the unknown ahead. Stay with us. Many of us have computers, but we probably never stop to think what happens to our PC when we trade it in or set it out along the curb for the sanitation worker to pick up when it's become outdated. For years now, environmentalists have expressed concerns about old computers not being recycled and ending up in landfills. The plastic shells from monitors and CPUs take up valuable space, and now a major computer manufacturer is taking steps to change this. Steps that the rest of the industry may follow. Stephen Westcott has the story.
IBM is now selling what it says is the world's first personal computer made with 100% recycled plastic resin. It's called the IntelliStation E-Pro. Ender Wadera, senior engineer at IBM, says the plastic comes from several sources.
And one of the sources is the obsolete computers. And then the second source is what we call sprues and runners. That is the byproduct when they are molding parts. And also, it can come from the water bottles, which you see in offices. They are made from polycarbonate resin.
Wadera says the plastics also come from recycled window panes. A total of 3.5 pounds of plastic are used to make the shell for the IntelliStation's CPU, or central processing unit. In addition, he says, IBM is designing a keyboard and monitor built from recycled materials. But IBM doesn't do the recycling itself. The company contracts with a recycling firm that buys and grinds up the old plastic, according to Wadera.
Then if there's a need to, they will reformulate them to our engineering specifications, match our requirements in terms of mechanical performance, thermal performance, flammability performance. Then they sell it to us. And we do not have any molding in IBM Corporation, but what we do is to ask our molders to buy those materials and then use them to produce parts for IBM Corporation.
Today, more and more communities are recycling plastic bottles, bowls, and containers of all shapes and sizes. You would think with so much plastic resin being reused, it would be easy for computer manufacturers to find the right materials. But Ender Wadera says it isn't that simple. He says finding materials that meet all the requirements needed to make a sturdy, reliable computer is just one reason why manufacturers haven't used recycled plastics more in production.
Number one is to get the proper resin to meet your requirements. And we have very, very stringent requirements, which include that the material must perform. That's one requirement. Number two, long-term reliability. That it has to have long-term reliability. Number three, safety. That we do not compromise safety. It has to have the proper flame retardancy. And then number four, cost also. Very important.
It may sound strange to some folks, but using recycled materials like plastic can actually cost more than using original materials. In the case of computer companies, the added cost of using recycled plastics could increase the cost of the PC and put the company at a disadvantage in the marketplace. Ender Wadera says the plastics used to make the IntelliStation did not force the company to raise the price and says the company is actually saving 20% on one of the parts of the CPU shell. In terms of applications, IBM spokesman Ray Gorman says the computer is designed for high-performance graphics.
Hollywood studio animators, for example, would use this, or people doing mechanical design, such as designing automobiles, that sort of thing. So anybody who's involved in digital content creation or mechanical computer-aided design, those sorts of activities. So really high-definition, intensive graphics.
The IntelliStation E-Pro is one of several Windows-based workstations and commercial PCs by IBM that feature Intel's new Pentium 3 microprocessor. The IntelliStation sells for around $2,100. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. America is losing its farmland. The last agricultural census shows that we lost 14 million acres in the five-year period from 92 to 97. And in rapidly growing states like California, the rate is particularly high. Also disturbing because those are some of our most productive lands. So American agriculture being the most effective food production system in the world is in the balance, and the question is, are we doing enough to save farmland, the essential building block of our food supply? I have three very knowledgeable guests with me today. They bring expertise from various perspectives. Joan Commonore is director of the Resource Conservation and Community Development Division of the Natural Resource Conservation Service, which is part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She's in Washington. Ralph Grassi is president of the American Farmland Trust. That's a private nonprofit organization which is dedicated to preserving American farmland. He, too, is in Washington. And Henry Rodegertz is attorney for the Department of Environmental Advocacy in the California Farm Bureau. That is an organization which represents the interests of farmers and ranchers. So, Joan Commonore, from the federal side of things, let's start with you. How bad is this situation, and is the loss continuing as we've seen it in the past?
Yes, I think it is a major concern for everyone. According to our information, since 1960, we've averaged a loss of 1.5 million acres of farmland a year. That means loss being that it was converted to other uses. It's very much on the national radar screen.
And let me stop you right there. When you say converted to other uses, what is the most prevalent form of use that steals our farmland, if I could put it that way?
I would think the most prevalent use is as the city continues to expand, the farmland is converted to shopping malls, housing developments, roadways, all of the other components of our city living.
Indeed, we're simply mauling our farmlands to death. Ralph Grassi from the Farmland Trust, your organization is dedicated to stopping this trend. What are some of the things that you folks are doing?
Well, Peter, we're working on a number of fronts at American Farmland Trust. First, of course, is we're trying to make sure we understand the issue and where it's happening. For example, over the last 10 years, about 500,000 acres of prime and unique farmland has been lost per year to urban sprawl, and that's the very best. So analysis and making sure people understand the problem, and then providing tools and techniques for local communities and state governments to address the problem, because this is an issue that has to be addressed at the local level. And finally, at the federal level, trying to get the federal house in order. There are too many things the federal government does right now that subsidize sprawl, which makes it even more difficult to promote conservation.
We'll get back to that in a moment. And Henry Rodegertz from the California Farm Bureau, how do your members see this? And let me just clarify that in a moment. I've been to any number of meetings with Farm Bureau folk who talk about the need to preserve farmland, but then when you talk about restrictions on their land that might stop it from being used in some other way, many farmers oppose that. Where do your people come out?
Well, I think that is a concern of agriculture. We need to emphasize the fact that agriculture is a business. It is not simply open space. And any of these programs to curtail the continued urban sprawl that's gobbling up our farmland, it needs to take into consideration the fact that we are have to work with these viable agricultural enterprises in whatever plan we come up with. I think that California agrarians are prepared to put some encumbrances on their land in order to keep them viable agricultural enterprises, but they're not enamored with this in perpetuity concept. We need to have reasonable ways in which folks can exit from these encumbrances on their land if, in fact, it's no longer possible to have a viable agricultural enterprise this protected property.
Let me ask you a question about that. Obviously, if I've got a business that involves a factory or something like that, and it becomes no longer viable, I can dump the factory and build another one someday. When you dump the farmland, when that becomes mauled, it's gone forever. So doesn't that put kind of a different spin on this whole question of protection and where we're going?
Well, it most certainly does, because you've got 3% of the farmland in America, in California, which is producing, for example, 55% of the nation's supply of vegetables, fruits, and nuts. We cannot afford to lose that. But at the same time, in keeping with the free enterprise and protection of private property rights, we have to reconcile these concerns. And I don't have a ready answer at this point in time, and neither does California agriculture, but we're sure working on it.
Now, let's get back to a question that that Ralph raised about things that the federal government is doing. While it professes to and does provide a lot of aid for farmers, it also does things that chew up farmland. I'm thinking about indirect or economic things like an inheritance tax, which can make it pretty tough to pass farms back and forth, and subsidizing a sprawl and so on. Is your agency, Joan, focused on any of this? Are you an advocate in the circles of the Beltway to try to change some of these governmental programs?
We certainly try to bring those points of view to the table as policies are being discussed. I do have responsibility for a program that on the positive end of things, where through the Farmland Protection Program that was part of the 1996 Farm Bill, we partner with state or local governments, because we certainly agree that these decisions are local as well as individual, that where there's a willing farmer or rancher or forest landowner who wants to invest in future generations to have that farm space still there, we partner with state and local governments and will provide some financial assistance to help purchase conservation easements on the land. We certainly want to make sure that those investments are strategic in nature. That is, we're not going to preserve the last farm that's already in the center of town, but on the outskirts where it's still strategic to have local decisions on keeping open space and rural uses intact, then that's where we want to help be a financial partner, and we can also provide conservation assistance to the individual landowners on good conservation practices so they're maintaining the health of their farmland at the same time keeping it in open space.
Now, Ralph, Joan mentioned the word conservation easement. For our listeners who may not be familiar with that concept, run it by us quickly, and also tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing at the Farmland Trust as it relates to conservation easements.
Glad to, Peter. A conservation easement is simply a contract between the landowner and a government agency or a nonprofit group that then is attached to the deed of the property, which restricts certain uses in the future. So the easements that we promote and the Farmland Protection Program at USDA promotes simply remove the right to subdivide the property in the future. So it's a contract between the landowner and the public for some consideration. It might be a tax benefit, a deduction on your income tax or estate taxes, or it might be for cash, as programs like Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and California now have to buy the conservation easement. But it's essentially the legal framework for an agreement between the landowner and the public. And yes, they are in perpetuity, although in some states they provide for the review of these easements in 25 or 30 years to be assured that they continue to meet the goals.
Now, is your organization promoting easement programs around the country? Is this an area of growth for you?
We're very much promoting. In fact, our organization is expanding rapidly to meet the needs and demands for these kinds of programs. We'll be opening 5 new offices this year because of the demand at the local level for these kinds of programs to provide communities with the use of conservation easements, which are the tool that go with purchase of development rights. Many of your listeners may have heard that term. When you purchase the development rights, in effect, you put a conservation easement on the land. But that's something we're very much involved in, not just in helping the community develop the program and design it for them, but in making sure the incentives are generous from the federal and state level.
Now, Henry, California has got the most probably productive and profitable agricultural economy in the country.
We like to believe
it also
that. It's a $27 billion economy.
It is also the home of places like Silicon Valley. And my guess is that if you've got an acre of ground that can be growing some of that great California produce or growing microwave chips, the chips win. How does, given the situation in California, how does the farm economy possibly survive on its best land, given the kind of competition that is up against?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, because along with this precious land resource we have in California, which is really unique, in order to make it productive, we need water. And without that water component, you can't make that land productive. And the Los Angeles area consumes a great quantity of California water. We're looking at a $500 billion economy in the Los Angeles area, and we're looking at a $27 billion agricultural economy. And so when you just look at it from the pure economic point of view, who's going to win out?
So you raise an interesting issue. You're saying that not only do you have to protect the land, but if the land doesn't have water naturally, which is true in other parts of the country, if you don't protect the water as well, you're not going to keep the farm economy going.
That's right.
And so that's part of the whole question of protection of farmland beyond just the acreage.
And many of your listeners may not appreciate the fact that California is a Mediterranean climate. We have no rain from about the 1st of May through November. California's agricultural productivity comes because we have plumbed the state. We move water from one end of the state to the other in a system that is unmatched in the history of the world.
And yet the critics say that agriculture is incredibly wasteful. You're still spraying spray irrigation and things like that use too much water.
Statistically, you just cannot bear out the fact that California's consumption of water in the agricultural sector is becoming less efficient. It is, in fact, becoming much more efficient. Drip irrigation, sprinkler systems, we are using less water now than we were 10 years ago, and that will continue to decline. But the answer to the water problems in California is not conservation solely. That's just one of the cards. We need to increase our storage capacity, but we're getting a little bit off.
Okay, just a few seconds each. The most important thing that has to be done next to preserve farmland. Joan Commoner from USDA, what's the highest thing on the agenda?
I would say it's a higher degree of awareness and local decision-making and commitment about what's important to the local communities.
Okay. Ralph Grassi.
Well, it's probably two-pronged, Peter. One is government has to reassess all of the programs that are now inducing the kind of behavior on the land that's taking place, the sprawling development, and strip away those that are incentives to that kind of sprawl. And secondly, we have to put in place a series of incentives to private landowners, from federal matching dollars to tax considerations at the federal, state, and local level, to help local communities protect the land, because ultimately it's a community-level decision.
Great. And Henry Rodegertz from California?
I have to parrot what Joan is saying. We have to raise the awareness level, and particularly directed to California, we have to raise the awareness level nationally and within the state what a terribly important resource we have in California. It feeds this country. It feeds the world.
Okay. Well, we've been speaking about saving America's farmland, what needs to be done, and, of course, how rapidly that has to happen. My guests have been Joan Commoner from one of the divisions of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Ralph Grossi from the American Farmland Trust, a private organization devoted to protecting farmland, and Henry Rodegertz from the California Farm Bureau. We're interested in your thoughts. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Berlich. You can reach us through our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. You can answer our questionnaire, send us a message, or listen to the Environment Show on your PC. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. Spring is here, which means many homeowners are getting uncontrollable impulses to dump herbicides all over their lawns to kill dandelions. Resist the temptation. An organic lawn care guide says the best way to get rid of dandelions does not involve weed killers at all. Dandelions love soil with a pH of 7.5. They thrive in soil that is alkaline. If the soil is made more acidic, which can be done by spreading gardener's sulfur, a substance which is organically benign, dandelions suffer, and grass does better. If you lower the pH to about 6.5, the grass has the advantage and can squeeze out the dandelion. Applying lime, which is alkaline, to a lawn covered with dandelions probably will make things worse. A professional soil test from your local extension office is recommended. There is another advantage to organic dandelion control. If it doesn't work, the dandelion is able to fulfill the purpose for which God put it in the lawn to start with, and that's to be the source of salad and homemade dandelion wine. That's our green tip for this week. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Craig Lambert, it's a river in Vermont where fog seduces him to row into chaos. In this portrait of place, Lambert reads from his new book titled Mind Over Water, Lessons of Life from the Art of Rowing.
On a Sunday morning in October, I am about to row another 3-mile head race. The Green Mountain Head in Putney, Vermont, is a small race limited to single and double sculls. Its entry form lists only 2 rules. Bow bowls required, no swearing. Near the space for age, it admonishes, no cheating. This race is famous for its regional prizes, maple syrup for first place, bag of apples for second, cider for third. Despite the light touch, the Green Mountain attracts a strong field of scholars, a field that I choose to weaken slightly by joining it. In Putney, the Connecticut River's high banks rise steeply like cathedral walls, enclosing us. No vaulted ceiling, but a sky, misted over now by a morning haze that the sun warms from the other side. Already we feel the rays, even if we do not yet see the light. The protection of the high banks means glassy flat water, ideal conditions. As I scull away from the tiny dock, the river feels like syrup against the oar blades. I look upstream. Between the wooded banks, plumes of mist rise majestically from the river surface. It is a Wagnerian scene. I can almost hear the opening bars of Tannhauser. Beautiful as it is, the mist also suggests the kind of temptation Odysseus must have encountered, since fog veils the upstream course, seducing us, perhaps, to row into chaos, collision, or onto rocks. Yet the morning fog is both curse and blessing. It confines us to the present moment because we cannot see ahead. So we must simply do an excellent job of being on course right now and trust that the future will take care of itself. The pursuit of long-term goals can resemble climbing a mountain in a dense fog. Imagine climbing through a fog so thick that you cannot see beyond your next step. You have no idea how much farther there is to go. Under these conditions, the key is simply to make each step a sound one and to keep going. Never cease moving upward, because your next step may be the one that places you on the summit. During the race, the sun finally burns off the mist, and we have a spectacular regatta on a superb New England fall day. I record a good time, but the day is successful for another reason. Rowing through that mist taught me something. Whenever I go out to row and come back having learned something on the water, that has been a successful trip. The river gods have surely blessed me, because so far, all my trips have been successful.
That was author Craig Lambert reading from his book titled Mind Over Water, Lessons on Life from the Art of Rowing. It's published by Houghton Mifflin.
Man is in a stream, falling leaves, a sycamore.
Maple syrup will not make your computer made of recycled plastic run any faster. And sending your toothbrush back for recycling is good for the environment, but won't save an acre of farmland. You need a copy of this show to see if any of this makes sense. Call 1-800-323-9262 and order show number 483. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.